own right. In the last couple minutes, what do you do when you're not, you know, out there fighting for justice?
Also, like to travel the world, Trevor. You know, being undocumented, that kind of cuts your wings, and you—I mean, you can leave the country, but you cannot come back. So now that I'm blessed to be a United States citizen and proud of that, I try to travel all over the world to carry on like missionary type work, and also to enjoy the different cultures. My wife and I travel once a year, and we try to go for 2 weeks, and we use 1 week to enjoy life and try to get away from work, and another week to help in different countries that are facing challenges. You know, we've been to Mexico, we've been to Cambodia, we've been to Cuba, we've been to a lot of different spots in the world that are, you know, just not doing as well as we are here, even though the United States has a lot of challenges right now. I think once you travel outside our country, you realize how blessed we are, and you're always excited to come back.
Absolutely. Sergio Garcia, thank you so much for your time, for joining me on the program today. I really enjoyed speaking with you and hearing your story.
I really appreciate your invitation, and hopefully look forward to talking to you in the future. And the book should be out shortly in the next couple months, the Spanish version. And if you're interested in the English version, Undocumented Lawyers available anytime. Just reach out to me and I'll get you a copy.
Thank you once again. Good night.
Good night.
Past episodes of the program can be found wherever you get your podcasts. A new episode each week. Thank you to the letter J. Cody Robertson for his original music. I'm Trevor Collins, and I can be reached, Trevor, at timeslikenow.com. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to speaking with you all next time.
It is the KBOO Fall Drive, and our theme is The Sounds of Democracy. Everything you hear on KBOO is, in its own way, the sound of democracy, because we are a community radio station. Community radio is one of the most democratic types of media. We're non-commercial and independent. We're supported by our members so that we can keep the airwaves democratic and continue to bring you the valuable voices of your community. Democracy is an experiment, and so is community radio. We're featuring content focused on democracy itself and democratic ideas across the schedule this drive, and you can support KBOO by donating right now. Go to kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44321, or click donate in the KBOO mobile app. Thank you.
Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is sculptor Julian Vos André. He's based in Selwood and is known for his quantum sculptures, or sculptures in a segmented style. Thanks for doing Art Focus in person, Julian.
Hi, Joseph. You're most welcome. Thank you for coming out here and looking at my studio. It's a pleasure.
So, Julian, you are known, I think people have seen your work around town. These are usually the human form in steel, but sliced into lots of layers and then held together with kind of pins. And then as you walk around them, they kind of disappear as all the steel plates line up. You call this your segmented style. So we're here in your studio. You have one, it's in stainless steel, kind of polished marks on it of polishing, and right next to it are two on crates, two wrapped sculptures. You can't tell what they are, but just tell us, what are these big things that are wrapped up?
Those two big sculptures that are wrapped up are basically two pieces that are ready to go down to California. One is a public work for the Bay Area, and it's a woman who is holding a tablet device, and there will be a light shining through the tablet device into her face, so it looks as if the tablet is illuminating her face. That there will be a busy light lamp, but then there will be a meditative slow pulse under the whole base. The other one is a piece that will go to the new Google campus at Mountain View, also California. That's why they get shipped together.
So you've developed this style, and obviously it's taken off. You know, if you're getting big corporate clients, just tell us what happened that you came upon this idea that you would want to make a. It's an optical illusion, but it's, you know, based in your scientific education.
Yeah, it's an optical illusion of sorts, but it's very simple. It's simple enough for any child or anybody to really grasp it right away when they see it in person. It's simply, basically, in that one angle where they disappear, 10% steel and 90% background. And because stainless also picks up the colors and the sparkle from the environment, it really seems to disappear at that one vanishing angle. The idea came from my graduate research in physics, where we did an experiment that looked at the transition from the quantum world to the classical world, and I envisioned myself to be one of those quantum objects that we analyzed, and that led to the idea of a walking man made out of slices, which is kind of how the physics, the mathematics of quantum physics, looks at objects moving through space as parallel wave fronts. So the slices are basically like wave fronts. That's how the idea came about in 2006.
So you're German and you studied physics, but then you transitioned to art and you went to PNCA here in Portland. What was the transition like from being a scientist every day to being an artist?
Yeah, that was quite the transition. I mean, not only from going from science to art, but also going from Europe to America, to United States. It was even before 9/11. It was a long time ago, 21 or whatever years. And actually, when I went into physics, before that I had been into drawing and painting. So I always thought I would want to become an artist. When I was 19, I decided to become an artist without really knowing what I wanted to do. But I knew I was really intrigued by painting and drawing and printmaking. When I got intrigued by physics, I felt it's really important to learn more about it because these claims are so outrageous that I felt I needed to check it firsthand and really do the experiments myself. But at some point, that was enough, and then a number of reasons led me to go to the United States and settle in Portland, where my then girlfriend lived, and she was the reason I came here. And so I looked around, what can I do? And I enrolled into art college without knowing much, and coming from this 8 years of universities all over Europe and kind of a very different mindset. And so it was very odd how the language was even different. You know, when people in art talk about volume and space and energy, they mean something completely different than a physicist. So there was quite a bit of cultural kind of back and forth going on and learning and growth on my part, I would say, over the next years. And so I found a way to settle with my scientific side and being open and, you know, I don't know the word. I don't want to say vague. It's not something negative, but it's being open to subtleties and non-logical things enough to kind of fuse these two worlds together for my own life and work.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I mean, the stereotype of the German is that they're very exacting. They're precise in language and in other things, in design. And yet the stereotype of the artist, especially on the West Coast, is they're kind of free-spirited and open-minded and totally trusting of sort of the non-physical world and the transcendent world. And I was wondering how you reconcile those two things.
It's an ongoing thing in my life. As a German, I like to be on time and I like that exacting stuff. But at the same time, I suffer from it. You know, I always refuse to wear a watch. I didn't do my homework. I was very non-German when I was growing up. And I understood how that is also shaping you in a negative way. This corset of doing stuff, you know, executive functioning stuff, right? And so it's for me not a coincidence that I came here, just to the West Coast especially. I mean, there's so much stuff going on spiritually. There's the indigenous peoples here have somehow, I don't know what really the reasons, but it's a different world, and I feel an incredible opening up over those last 20 years. In fact, I've been doing this my whole life, but this the United States experience and the West Coast experience have really kind of, especially the last years, expanded my horizon pretty drastically. And I just love that when you bridge those seemingly incompatible worlds.
The piece we're standing in is, it's a woman sitting down. She's got her legs under her, sort of folded behind her to one side. She's leaning on one hand. The other left hand is draped on her calf. And she's turned, her head's turned slightly to the left. And you know, it's a beautiful piece. What is the effect of walking around and having her disappear in terms of, you know, the aesthetic appeal of that?
Well, you know, she this piece came over some detours from the idea of looking at this Copenhagen Little Mermaid. And so that idea of this female calling out somehow. And so there was a number of works that were called one way or the other mermaids. And then I made a public work for Palm Springs. And this is her little sister, the one in Palm Springs called Isabel, and this is Annabelle. And so what happens is, especially with this piece, is that you see her facial expression. And when you walk around her towards that angle where you look into her eyes, where you see only the little bit of steel and mostly background, what you see mostly is the reflection of the cut edges. So it is as if the volume of the surface, the volume of the body is drawn into space with luminescent lines. And that's for me a really amazing thing that keeps kind of attracting me to this kind of style, because it reminds me of that we are not just our physical bodies, but in our essence we are light beings, and we are spirits, and we to see, it's almost like a person who's not here anymore, and you have this flash of a memory where you suddenly recognize the person, the in the facial features.
There's another piece just across the room, and it's wrapped in clear plastic, like it's ready to go, and it kind of looks like someone in a pinstripe suit. It's a character leaning forward, and a lot of your pieces have motion. I mean, are there any sculptures that you were inspired by for the way they handled motion in the human figure?
It's hard to tell. I noticed there's a piece by Emil Alzamora, is his name, that's leaning forward. And I made my first forward-leaning piece, and then I saw that piece, and it was like déjà vu, and I'm not sure if I'd seen it before, but I don't know if there's others. But that was definitely, I was like, wow, that's very similar, and I feel very, I can relate to that idea. You want to go away from the static and go in towards this kind of suspended feel of about to soar or move or fall or take off. And that's kind of what I've been doing in a number of these pieces, mostly driven by a technology that allowed it, you know, because if you do 3D scans, and that's a technology I use quite a bit, this has evolved a lot, and now we can do it in milliseconds. So we can actually work with models and have them fall, and then snapshot 3D scans as a starting point for the design.
So I should tell our listeners, we're in this studio, and it's got big high ceilings, skylights, tons of shelving, really big machines. I don't know what that red thing is with the two handholds.
A sandblaster.
Okay. But you have this room over here. It's, you know, you just open a gray door and you go in, and there's this fabulous 2x4 frame, circular kind of contraption covered in wires and Raspberry Pis and Canon digital cameras. So, and then inside there's a little square white platform. So I guess this is where you do your scanning, right?
That's correct, yeah. I realized that as I mentioned with the technology, there's only so much you can do with a standard scanning technology, because those are usually made for pieces of machinery. And so humans are not pieces of machinery. They're moving, they're breathing. So what I tried to find was a way to do almost instantaneous 3D scans. And the only way to do this is pretty much what's called photogrammetry. So you take hundreds of photos, 2D images from all different angles, and then you stick them in the computer and it spits out a 3D shape of the 3D object that was photographed from the different angles.
And you have someone who helps you with the technology side?
Yes, Ian is the person I'm working with. He is like a really brilliant kind of tech and computer guy, and he just loves to figure out puzzles like this. So we built this together.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Julian Vos Andre. He's a sculptor known in Portland for his quantum sculptures in the segmented style. So, Julian, I always love visiting artists who have a really good setup. So they're like mid-career, they've got a great studio, they've got a big client list, and they're really doing the work that they want to do. And you've got this photogrammetry 3D scan rig. So at what point did you, when you began doing this, did you do everything by hand and on paper and build everything yourself? And then how did you kind of outsource the bits you didn't want to spend time on?
Well, it's been a long trajectory. I started out with carving physically into big things and then slicing it up manually and then taking photos, digitizing the single slices. Then I had a stage where I would model, like traditionally modeling in 3D, in actual 3D, the piece, and then 3D scan it because that's easy to do, and then slice it segmented style. I've done other styles as well, but often a similar kind of workflow in the background. And so it evolved more and more towards stuff that works all in the computer. The workflow is now pretty much entirely in the computer up to the point where it gets fabricated. And then just like new technologies became available, and often they were so expensive or far away where movie studios are. So it's in this case, I felt it was really important to build this thing myself, because I couldn't get this particular job done in Portland.
The Portland sculptor Lee Kelly, when he's coming up with an abstract steel sculpture in his head, he'll draw it on paper, then he'll scan that, mess around with it in the computer, and then print it out really big, and then maybe draw on that, and then rescan that, and then eventually output it to machines that make the sculpture. So which parts of the whole process do you really like to, do you most enjoy doing? Do you find it is the most artistic part for you?
I mean, when I think about a new sculpture, I typically have a good idea of the site, and I get plans and renderings. Ideally, I'm on site myself. And that is one big part, is to just kind of listen to the spot and find out what it sort of needs. And that's a really satisfying thing if that comes to your mind or whatever, that object or that figure that wants to be there. Very often, in my feeling, is today the world seems so devoid of soul often that a figure is almost always a good thing because it brings a soul back into the space. So that's what I very often end up doing, that I feel, okay, this needs a figure. And then I contemplate, the culture of the background, the history of the place. Like right now I'm working on a piece based on a Maori chief in for New Zealand. So that's a really interesting thing. I've done a number of things which were very much tied to the local culture. Yeah, so that's an enjoyable part, but that's a relatively short part. You either have a good idea or you don't, and hopefully it's a good idea. But then comes the long phase of the design where I basically find models, do all the technical stuff and tweak and sculpt. And a lot of things, what I'm doing is I take parts of different 3D scans, for example, and then combine them in the computer. I sometimes take 3D prints and add clay and stuff like that. So I model with my hands in some cases and then rescan it to just get a feel for those parts to get it in the computer. And then, so that's 3D sculpting kind of like phase. And then typically for the segmented style, the longest phase is the one where I take each slice and turn them from raw cuts into beautiful curves that make sense. And it's not a mindless thing at all. It's because the computer doesn't know if a curve is important or not. Only you know that. And so if you have a curve at the nose, it makes a huge difference if you iron that out or not, because it's part of the character of the figure. If you have it on the back, you want to stylize it there, for example. It's like it's a very natural kind of process to stylize it with a mind or with an eye on where are we in the body, you know, so how it looks. Another really interesting aspect is where the pins are located. Like, that's kind of one of my joy things. I kind of do it in 2D. I design through this locations of the pins, and I step back when the piece is built for the first time and go like, wow, yeah, that worked out really well, or it didn't. Then I tweak it on the next run. And so in this case we're standing in front of right now, I did something pretty unusual. I placed a lot of pins very intentionally next to each other, so they make these lines of force, which is really important. This is structurally important because this piece is leaning forward on one tippy toe, and it's kind of insane actually to pull this off structurally, so it needs to be very thought through.
This piece of a woman, yes, a naked woman leaning forward, one leg bent, one arm out, but it's not finished, right? There's an arm missing.
Yeah, there's arms and hands missing, but it's almost there. So the foot will be off the ground, so there's only one foot that she's connected on. This is the first prototype, and this is actually a custom piece where she will be leaning over a pool. So there will be water here, and that's back there, where there will be stone under it. And so the next ones will be turned around, so they go towards their own base plate, like this one.
So you always work with a client? Is always by commission?
Not always. If something is super intriguing to me and I have this idea and I want to do it, then I do it either way. But these days, I'm kind of lucky enough that I often have an idea and then I run it by the galleries and they go like, oh yeah, that would be perfect for this client. And then often I get to make a prototype as a commission already, which is cool because then I can turn that into an addition and develop it that way.
Mm-hmm. What you were saying about how... You would think, because all the slices seem to be at about the same distance apart, whatever that is, you know, mm-hmm. an inch maybe. So you would think, oh, it's very mechanical. You just like, it's like putting a human through a deli slicer. But you're saying where you make the incision has to line up with the most interesting lines of the body. So
that too, yeah.
The woman,
exactly.
The woman's back twisted, you got shoulder blades, spine, and it has to accentuate that.
And I do a bunch of feedback between the 3D modeling and then the preliminary slicing to see how it fits with that pattern. But actually much more important even is when we assemble it at the end of the day when it's in pieces of steel. Steel is a very... When you ever heat it up, when you weld it, it distorts like crazy. So it's a lot of the trickiness of building these is to compensate all the time for things that move on you. So it's never really a boring deli slice type of thing. It's always very, very organic, you know, because if you look carefully, it's very non-linear. You know, there's lots of stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
Here, the titanium piece is a little different because titanium is much more able to not bend on you so much. So that is actually quite accurate.
Mm-hmm. How much of it then is purely your eye, you know, making decisions sort of against what the computer has given you?
It's, at the end of the day, I only trust my gut. You know, I used to not be like this, and I was like, no, I have to do it like this, and I learned the hard way that never works. So now I just double check everything, always redundancy, and I need to like it. If I don't like it, I just won't do it. That's true for every little design decision.
Is there a way of salvaging a full-size sculpture that you don't like?
No way. Whenever we touch a piece, we can have to throw it away at the end. If we can't reuse it for anything, unfortunately. This whole style that we're doing here is so reliant on new material. It's the opposite of recyclable.
That's not very green for a German.
It's probably not, but it's, you know, I don't know how to feel about this. Steel is inherently very, very energy consuming, so it's not great, especially not how we do it right now, using lots of coal, not only to heat it, but also to reduce it chemically. But it can be done electrically, and it's being tried now with hydrogen. On the other hand, it's a fantastically recyclable material. You know, you can always melt something and turn it back into steel. So that's actually wonderful. So it's not only terrible. I don't know. What I love about steel is it just holds up against gravity in this absolutely amazing way. You know, you cannot build anything stronger than using that material. It's just like, you know, the combination of density and tensile strength is such that you can make really complex things with it.
And then you use titanium when steel would rust, or when do you use titanium?
I started out with a Superwoman because I thought it would be just the right thing to make it out of titanium and not steel, because titanium sounds so cool, and I always wanted to use titanium. That's how I got into titanium. And then I had a bunch in my studio, and we made this one piece for the client who had this very, very demanding environment in Florida overlooking the ocean. And the piece I made in stainless for him would rust, so we actually making him like a version in titanium, just to, because that's much more corrosion resistant. But it's appealing for a number of reasons, but very hard to weld, very hard to work with.
You mean because it's hard? It's hard to cut?
It's everything is difficult. Like, you have to, when you, it comes to welding, it oxidizes much easier. So you have to be extremely careful about not contaminating your welds, every heated part, with oxygen. So you have to be like back perch everything, have everything in an environment of inert gas. And then if you sand it, it's not just that the more you lean on it, the more it gives. It's the opposite. If you lean on it, then it just heats it up locally, melting your pads, your sanding pads. It's just so mean, this thing. It's like, it's really, it doesn't want to be worked.
As we looked around your studio, you had so many other things going on apart from these, mm-hmm. you know, these segmented human figures. So you've got human figures that are like wireframe in different yeah. colors, more geometric frame, triangles and triangles all forming a human shape. Then you have what look like maquettes, so small models of dancers that you 3D printed, you know, like a foot tall. And then you have some of them made in bronze. And then it seems like you have all these other styles going on, but really you focus on this one style. Is that correct?
Yeah, I focus on it because it's just so incredible for a number of reasons. It gives rise to a number of different interpretations. It's very eye-catching, you know, and it's also, it's just really beautiful. You know, it's hard to explain it, but, I'm still not bored by it, so I still like it too. It's good.
Where can people see your work around Portland?
I have my oldest public piece is here on Hawthorne, actually, like Hawthorne and maybe 44th or something. That's a spiral based on a protein structure, which I made as a student when I went to PNCA. That was part of my thesis work. And then I have another piece at the PCC campus, the Portland Community College, on Division and like 79, almost 82nd
Street. Oh, yeah, the southeast campus.
Yeah, there's the library, and in front of it is an about 8 foot tall female figure reading a large book in that segmented style.
Mm-hmm. Are there any more that you're going to produce for Portland?
No, not at this point.
So you have galleries, right, in Switzerland, yeah. San Francisco, and Palm Desert. What's the gallery life like for you? Do the gallery keep calling you up and saying do this, do that, or do you have complete autonomy?
Yeah, I mean, if it's, you know, they ideally call up and say, hey, when can you have this done? I have a client who bought this, because I do additions, so, and that's typically what the galleries sell. So, but I have some gallery people who are very good at, they have like clients that are public and that need public art, and often it's a collaboration, even when it comes to thinking about what would fit, what would work as a sculpture. So I actually appreciate that. I'm not like ego-driven in the sense that, oh, only me can have the idea. You know, I love to actually brainstorm and come up with stuff if it feels good.
Yeah. So I've interviewed quite a few public artists who do things at airports and stuff, and it's such a long, complicated collaboration. But they enjoy it because it pays well and, you know, it's big-scale work. And if you're a good collaborator, it's enjoyable. Do you like that kind of thing?
Yeah, it depends really on the situation. I mean, sometimes it doesn't work so well, but very often it works well, and it can be fantastic, actually, because if you rely on a network, if you know the electrician will have the right stuff there and the lighting guys and da-da-da-da, it's all lined up, that's beautiful. That's doesn't get better than that.
Are there any other of your works around the world that people can look out for as they travel?
Yeah, there's quite a few. I mean, actually, I'm not sure it says on my website, but on my resume, I think I have a list of all the works, but I don't think I have a map. But in the U.S., there's probably 20 or so, I would say, public works.
Where would be one that people might
go see? The most recent one we installed was in January. That was a big piece for Columbus, Ohio. which is a group of five grown-ups, one kid and a chicken, for the social justice park there associated with the church. The name is based on a quote by Martin Luther King. It's called Our Single Garment of Destiny. The idea of a group of people becoming one, kind of like a quantum object becoming a coherent object, one. So basically the individuality is just a manifestation of an underlying oneness. That idea is the driving force for wanting to do good in the world, and kind of, because if you realize we are one, then if I heard you, then I heard myself. That idea.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Julian Vos André. He's a sculptor based in Selwood, Portland, and he's known for his quantum sculptures, and his website is julianvosandre.com. Thanks very much for inviting us into your studio, Julian, and doing Art Focus in person.
You're most welcome. Thank you for coming out and for the donuts.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Have him on my wall.
Está sintonizando KBOO Portland en el 90.7 FM y a través de la internet en kboo.fm.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes 21 de septiembre del 2021. India dijo el lunes que reanudará la exportación de las vacunas COVID-19 de producción nacional a otras naciones 5 meses después de suspender las exportaciones de inyecciones de AstraZeneca en medio de una ola devastadora de infecciones. Mientras tanto, un nuevo estudio encuentra que las naciones ricas han almacenado más vacunas de las que las poblaciones están dispuestas a consumir, alrededor de 100 millones de dosis.